Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to today's chapter of The Big Picture, live here on Radio Islam International and Radio Al Ansar. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsot, standing in for Brother A.B. Dawji, who is got the flu at the moment. Anyway, it's been happening around the world, and locally, there's been, as usual, never a week goes by, or should we say, never a dull moment. Just to go through a few things, well, on the local scene, we're going to have a guest, inshallah, coming in on live telephonically on air at about 11:35. Inshallah, we're trying to get hold of her, and then we'll discuss the local matters then. But looking elsewhere, 3 weeks ago, Brother AB called me, sorry, Mark, 3 weeks ago, Brother AB called me to discuss Sudan and what's happening there at the moment. Now, as you know, that the former dictator Omar al-Bashir was overthrown in a coup in April this year after 30 years of ruling the country. And then there was, a protest in between. There was calls for civilian rule because the military took over. There were, people have been killed, etc., violence. Nevertheless, at the time when Brother AB called me, that same week, they announced a historic transition deal, which had to be ratified by the middle of August. So, alhamdulillah, last Saturday on the 17th of August, Sudan's main opposition coalition and the ruling military council formally signed a final power-sharing deed in Khartoum, paving the way for a transition to a civilian-led government, which, after a long period of negotiations, followed the overthrow of, as I said, long-time leader Omar al-Bashir in the wake of mass protests. The deal was signed between Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who was the deputy chief of the Transitional Military Council, known as the TMC, and Ahmed al-Rabi, who represented the opposition, known as the Alliance for Freedom and Change, which was an umbrella group of all opposition parties. Several heads of states, including the Ethiopian Prime Minister, who was instrumental in getting the two parties together, Abiy Ahmed, as well as the South Sudanese President, Salva Kiir, which was a very good gesture for him to attend as well. Just to give us some pointers, the power-sharing deal creates a joint military and civilian sovereign council to rule for a little period of over 3 years until elections are held. Under the government, the 11-member council includes 6 civilians and 5 soldiers. A military leader would head the council for the first 21 months, followed by a civilian leader for the next 18 months. It would also establish a cabinet appointed by the activists and a legislative body. Under the power-sharing agreement, the Sovereign Council would include 5 members selected by the TMC, including its head, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. And then 5 members would be picked up by the will be picked out by the main opposition coalition, which includes a woman and a journalist. Now, the 11th member, who is supposed to be civilian, was agreed upon by both sides and is a Coptic Christian judge. So that brings, together a good harmony of the different religions and, different groupings of civil society and the military. The main opposition alliance nominated the economist by the name of Abdullah Hamdok to serve as the prime minister in the country's transitional government, who was sworn in this past Wednesday. Now, the deal also included the establishment of an independent investigation into the crackdown on protesters by security forces. As you would know, in June, at the time of Eid, troops violently dispersed the protesters. Sorry, at the time of Ramadan, just before Eid, troops violently dispersed the protesters' main sitting outside the military headquarters in Khartoum, killing dozens of people, actually over 100 people, that plunged the fragile nation into crisis. So that was what happened in Sudan. And alhamdulillah, everybody's optimistic, people are celebrating, and the country wants to move forward. Why is Sudan so important to us? Because it is the one country in Africa that embraced Sharia law at the time in the 80s and have implemented it since. However, unfortunately, whether you're a Muslim country or not, whether you follow the Sharia or not, corruption is everywhere. And, it's no fault, you know, people, critics will say they, oh, but you know, there's this loophole and that loophole. There's no such thing. If the law is implemented correctly and appropriately at the right time, then you shouldn't have problems. But corruption has no color, no race, no creed, no religion. When elsewhere in the world, well, you know, Trump, big mouth Trump, or should I say Trump who blows his trumpet, doesn't fail to, you know, entertain and amuse us with his tirades and with his shenanigans. You know, it was quite amusing that Trump actually made an offer earlier this week to buy the island of Greenland, which is the world's largest island, which is under Denmark's territory. So he made an offer to the Danish government. I don't know how, what was the offer, but nevertheless, he made an offer to the Danish government to buy Greenland, because Greenland is known to have untapped resources, to buy Greenland and say, we'll take off Greenland from your responsibility. And, you know, expectedly, the Greenland government said no. And because of this, Trump decided to snub the Danish Prime Minister on a visit. He was supposed to visit Denmark and he abandoned that visit. Kind of sound like a child throwing his toys out of the cot. Anyway, and then in the week, he tweeted, you know, to say that he's the chosen one by God. And this because an Israeli radio DJ made a, you know, on one of his shows said that, you know, Trump is chosen by God because he's the king of, he should be like the king of Israel because of what he's done for the Israeli people. And that we all know because he recognized Jerusalem as the capital and he moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, as well as recognized the Golan Heights. And you know, it's just a matter of time before he recognizes, or, you know, formally recognizes the annexation of the West Bank. So Trump feels now because one radio DJ in Israel has praised him, so he feels he's chosen by God. And he actually went on saying that, you know, I'm so glad that, and he quoted the DJ for saying, for, you know, for referring to me as the greatest president in the world. It's quite a, you know, as if, I'm sure if AB was here, you can imagine the jokes that he would have made about this. Right, going elsewhere to Hong Kong. Well, the world's known as the world's richest city, you know, the most expensive property market, one of the highest income earners in the world, has been going through a wave of protests for the past few weeks. Hong Kong is a classic example of civil disobedience that has brought onto center stage and has been generally relatively peacefully. The Hong Kong people were the citizens of the special administrative region, which is known as the SAR of China, won their rights to be respected. And these rights were agreed upon between China and Britain on the transition and handover of Hong Kong from British rule to China in 1997, whereby the agreement stated that for the next 50 years from 1997, Hong Kong will, the Chinese government will respect the sovereignty of Hong Kong and allow, you know, the democracy, allow freedom, allow, you know, the rights of people to be fulfilled, which is different, which is obviously totally different to what is in mainland China. However, you know, given Beijing's power, they have been trying to obviously shift the goalposts and trying to erode those freedoms. And the Hong Kong citizens are not taking it very lightly. In fact, you can, from the way the city has been brought to a standstill several times, including cancellations of international flights in and out of Hong Kong, shows that, you know, the economy has been severely affected. People haven't been going to work. Obviously, they obviously have been taking a cut in their salaries, etc. However, but they are resolute and steadfast in saying that, listen, we are not going to back down until our rights are respected and agreed upon. In Malaysia, well, there has been a criticism of and a lot of talk about Dr. Zakir Naik, who is in exile at the moment, or self-imposed exile from India, due to him being hounded by the BJP government on so-called terrorism charges. And those terrorism charges have been then changed to money laundering charges, because actually the Indian government under the BJP cannot find any fault with Zakir Naik, and they're looking for any excuse to shut him up. That's the bottom line. Now, for those of you who are familiar with Zakir Naik and not, Dr. Zakir Naik is a medical doctor who was based in Bombay, headed an organization called the Islamic Research Foundation. He has always said that praised Ahmadinejad, the late Sheikh Ahmadinejad, as his mentor, and been inspired by him. In fact, the first time when I heard Dr. Zaki Naik without looking at the TV, I actually thought did I have to speak in, because he even had the same style of speaking and, you know, tone and voice. So Zaki Naik has been known to attract huge crowds to his talks. In, you know, many a times they are you know, the capacity crowd is in excess of 50,000 people coming to listen to him, to his debates. He's debated with Christians, with Hindus, with pundits, with atheists, name it, and he's always been, you know, challenging them and putting them on the back foot. And the man is gifted with knowledge. He knows the Quran, he knows the Bible, he knows the Hindu scriptures of the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita. He knows, you know, all the scriptures inside out, chapter and verse. And the man is gifted with knowledge. And obviously, you know, knowing that, you know, he is the, should we say, the iconic voice for Islam in India, knowing that how, you know, India has been suppressing Muslims over the years, but especially under the BJP rule, that Zakir Naik has obviously is seen as a threat to them, not politically, not in any other way. In fact, he's only perceived as a threat, but he's not a threat. And the catalyst on into Haunin Zaki Naik took place at the time of the Bangladesh bombings in Dhaka in 2016, whereby he was accused by both the Indian government and the government of Sheikh Hasina in Bangladesh of being inspiring these the bombers, you know. And you can know that from the way this whole thing was put together, it's so flimsy, it's so pathetic, you know, it was a blame game and a scapegoat. And he was overseas at the time and knew when the warrant of arrest was issued, he decided then to flee to Malaysia, and he was granted permanent residency thereafter. Now, well, what has happened that India has been putting a lot of pressure on Malaysia to extradite Zakir Naik back to India. Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who returned to the Prime Ministership of Malaysia last year, May, after 15 years in retirement, has was known to be a supporter of Zakir Naik, has come out and said, no, we will not deport him. He is welcome to live in this country, and, you know, because at the end of the day, you cannot guarantee us a fair trial. And despite all the assurances and promises from India, and Mahathir is no fool, he knows that obviously with the current government in charge, Zakir Naik will not receive this fair trial. And he fears that if he's extradited back to India, he may be harmed or killed. So, but what happened was that Zakir Naik was very quiet in the first couple of years while he was there, and has resurfaced from last year giving his talks since Mahathir has come into power, and he's been allowed to give his talks on Islam and Quran, etc., which is not a problem. But recently, he was provoked, but what would have been perceived to be saying that he attacked the Chinese and the Indians in Malaysia. The Chinese make up 30%, the Indians make up 10%. And, basically instigated the race racial harmony in the country, and said that the Chinese should go back to China, and the Indians in Malaysia support are more loyal to Modi than to their own government. But it all stemmed out from a talk which he gave in the city of Kota Bharu in the state of Kelantan, which is under the Islamic Party rule, and whereby his speech was taken out of context. And, you know, because of the Chinese and those Indians that have said he must be, the government must extradite him back to Malaysia. And he criticized them to say, if you want me extradited, why don't you leave? Nevertheless, the police had stepped in and they said, stop all your public talks until this matter is over. And Mahathir said, look, we are not extraditing Zakir Naik. He's welcome to live here. But at the same time, he can give his talks on Islam, but do not speak about racial politics in Malaysia, because it is a very sensitive issue. Anyway, we're taking a news break and we'll return shortly, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the second part of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International. I'm Mustafa Dasso speaking from the Durban studios. Okay, just before the ad break, we spoke about Dr. Zakir Naik and Malaysia's Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, steadfast in his position that he will not deport Zakir Naik back to India for reasons which he is very concerned that the man will not get a fair trial and his safety may be in jeopardy. And we can all see that that is a possibility if we look at what's happening in Kashmir. It doesn't take rocket science to figure out. Yes, India does have a good judiciary like how we have here in South Africa, but because of the size of the country, because of the population, because of the corruption, by the time cases go through court takes years. I mean, you must have heard of recently in the past few months where certain individuals, Muslims, who were accused of certain riots or racial tensions, etc., were freed like after 20 years, you know, because, etc. And then, you know, victims of the Gujarat riot only saw justice recently after 18 years. So you can see that this is the big problem that India has. And the thing is that what can happen to Zakir Naik if he's extradited back to India? How long does he wait for his trial? Will he get a fair trial? Well, chances are, yes, he may get a fair trial if the, you know, if the merits of the judiciary are there in the sense of what you've seen in these recent cases. But how long can it take? It can take anything from 1 year to 20 years or more. Nevertheless, coming to Kashmir now, the, as we all know that on Friday, the 2nd of August, which was 20 days ago, over 3 weeks ago, Friday the 22nd of August, it was announced by the Indian government that they're cancelling the Amarnath Yatra pilgrimage in Kashmir, which is held in the southern Jammu region, which is held every year from the middle of July to the middle of August and ends on Independence Day, which is the 15th of August. This 2 weeks before the pilgrimage was supposed to end, it was abruptly cancelled, and the people were told to leave the state, citing, you know, fears of, you know, possible terrorist attacks that may be coming about. And this was all the pretext for the Monday, the 5th of August, which is known as the Dark Day of Kashmir, whereby the Home Minister of India, Amit Shah, who is also the chairman of the BJP party. Now, just to tell you about Amit Shah, if one thinks that Modi is bad and threatening, Amit Shah is far worse. And although in the last government he did not serve in the cabinet, but this time he insisted that he needed a post in the cabinet, and he took over the Home Ministry, which is a very important post for various strategic regions to serve the agenda. Now, Amit Shah, you know, on the morning of Monday, 5th of August, which was 20 days ago, stood up in Parliament and held a document to say that I've got a presidential decree signed and stamped to say that as of today, Article 370 and Article 35A will be revoked. Now, those of you who can recall last week when Brother AB called me to discuss Kashmir, we were talking about it and I discussed Article 370 and 35A as well as the criticisms behind those articles. And then, of course, the show had to stop because of the 12 o'clock news. So just to continue a bit from there, in the sense that the few developments that have taken place, the Kashmir is still under lockdown. In fact, the curfew, they've basically enforced the curfew of tightened the curfew since yesterday because people, civil society wanted to protest. The movements are there, shops are still closed, people cannot get basic foods and medicine. It's basically a Gaza type of siege at the moment that is taking place. And given that, Kashmir's geographical position, a lot of goods have to come in from out of state and medicines, etc. And with the current siege and lockdown, you know, it is virtually impossible to, you know, get things done. Mobile services are still cut off, so is the internet. There's a partial restoration of landlines and only partial movement of people in and out. Many those who are residing out of state and are working are able to get in and out, and that too very limited. The announcement was made on the 5th of August and the lockdown was then, and 3 days before Bakrid, the people were promised that Bakrid is coming on the 12th of, or Eid al-Adha is coming on the 12th of August, and they will be allowed, they will ease the restrictions to enable them to, you know, prepare for Eid celebrations and to enjoy the day of Eid. But that never happened. In fact, it was regarded as the most depressing Eid ever held in Kashmir. You know, with the main Eidgahs and that cancelled, and people had to just go to the nearest mosque and conducted Eid prayers, and that too, not everybody was lucky. So you're having that sort of situation, and Imran Khan, of course, has been very vocal, and you have to commend him for his stance, because, when Imran Khan came into office you know, critics have seen him as a very passive type of person. Yes, he's a very level-headed person. Passive, I don't think so, especially in light of what's been happening with the Kashmir crisis. He's been very vocal. He's been, you know, telling the international community that, look, if you people do not do anything about Kashmir, it's going to get out of hand. There's going to be radicalization. There's going to be militancy. And, you know, he's said straight out that the way the Indian government under the BJP is behaving at the moment is that of how the Nazis and under Hitler behaved, and also said that, you know, he's got fears that there'll be a Srebrenica type of massacre looming if the international community does not wake up and put pressure on India. Now, you must know that India, honestly speaking, does not care, if we want to put it that way, because as long as you got an idiot like Trump in America, who is only worried about himself and his, being chosen by God, as he claims, and his prestige, and lies all the time. And that was evident when Imran Khan did an official visit to the States in July, whereby he said that, Modi asked him to be a mediator in the Kashmir crisis. And this came out, and immediately the Indian government came out with a press release to say that it's not true. So, you know, at the end of the day, you can't count on Trump to be an honest broker, of course. But then just see that how the USA has been behaving in the Israel-Palestine crisis. They have never been an honest broker, and more so now with Trump, with his recognition of Jerusalem as a capital and, you know, moving the embassy. You will not see any, and with his son-in-law, you know, calling the shots, being his personal advisor and being a Zionist, ardent Zionist himself, that this is not a possibility. So don't expect anything to be here in India in the Kashmir crisis. At the same time, Russia is not going to get involved, for the simple reason Russia is a very close ally of India. And at the same time, Putin is also, as much as what Modi has done with Kashmir, Putin is also complicit and guilty with what he's done with Crimea and Chechnya, just to give you a few examples. So the thing is that, you know, annexation is a norm there. Yes, you've seen China being supportive of Pakistan for the simple reason as China has got some territorial hold over Kashmir, which is the Aksai Chin region in the northeast and east part of Kashmir. Though it makes up about 15-20% of the entire Kashmir area and is very sparsely populated, with a population between 10,000 to 100,000. However, this is China's territorial hold, and because of this, they will side with Pakistan, so much so that they took it to the UN last week, right under Imran Khan's request. It was a closed-door meeting of the UN Security Council of just the five permanent members and the 10 non-permanent members. India and Pakistan were not in that particular closed-door session. However, there was a lot of lobbying behind the scenes, right? And, you know, India's ambassador to the UN is a Muslim. His name is Sayyid Akbaruddin. And he has been very, you know, you can say pompous about the whole situation, says this is an internal matter and it's got nothing to do with the rest of the world. And, you know, yes, there is a lockdown, but we're going to ease the lockdown within the coming few days. In fact, that was over a week ago, and just yesterday it's been, you know, word has come out that the lockdown has actually been strengthened. So, really speaking, you know, the UN is not going to do much, but it's the only body that is capable of addressing this matter apart from the International Court. For what we found, that this was the first time Kashmir has ever been brought to the table at the UN after 50 years. The only way to obviously ramp up the Kashmiri cause is through civil society, NGOs and action groups that are there, that are taking the cause of the Kashmiri people forward. Here in South Africa, you have what is known as the South African Kashmir Action Group and the Friends of South African Friends of Kashmir. Those are just two to name, as well as international action groups as well. You have certain personalities that are very vocal and, about the situation in Kashmir. One of them is the famous writer Arundhati Roy, who is based in Delhi, who is not Muslim, but she is very vocal about the BJP government. She has been spoken extensively on Kashmir and has, you know, made it known that this is a human rights tragedy. Then you have a Kashmiri, Indian Kashmiri academic who is based in London by the name of Natasha Kaul, who is also, a writer and very vocal as well. And she's been actually also both Arundhati Roy and Natasha Kaul have been on Mehdi Hassan's shows on Al Jazeera about Kashmir matter. And if you just Google the names, you'll find recent articles, one by Arundhati Roy in the New York Times, and Natasha Kaul wrote for the Foreign Policy magazine. But they always, these are people to follow. Also, the defense analyst who I quoted last week, Ajay Shukla, S-H-U-K-L-A, who is based in Delhi, defense analyst. You'll get to know from him as well. And then there's a personality who I've come across from last year, actually the year before, and I've been following him very closely, who is from Australia, but is between Australia and the United States. His name is, he goes by the name of C.J. Wellman. Now, just to tell you who C.J. Wellman is. C.J. Wellman is an atheist, and he was actually an Islamophobe, right? He was an outspoken Islamophobe who said that, who actually openly admitted that I have been bigoted and I've also been a racist of some sort. Now, after, criticizing the Quran, which he wrote a book about, and he then decided to, wait a minute, something of curiosity has troubled him. So he decided to read the book of our beloved Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam and do more research into the life of the Prophet and went deeper. And his whole views on Islam have changed. He's done a total 180-degree turn. So from Islamophobe to one who has been a champion for Muslim causes around the world, right? People have criticized him to say, but he's an atheist. At the end of the day, people are very judgmental, but look at what he's trying to achieve. He's actually been at the forefront of the Palestinian cause. He's very vocal on Kashmir. He's, he's also been taking up the causes of the people of Syria under the torture of Assad, the people of Yemen under the bombs of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. He's talked about Islamophobia in Europe and the States, especially France, how Muslims are treated with double standards. He has also highlighted the Rohingya cause and the cause of the Uyghurs. So here's another personality to follow, and you'll find that a lot of good articles. In fact, he does his own online podcast. He's also tied up with Cage UK and the UK, which is an advocacy group for Muslims. So you have these personalities here to know. If you want to know about Kashmir, follow them and you'll get some good info on it. As well as now looking at Indian media, well, India is bustling with media groups, whether it's online media, whether it's the print media, whether it's TV stations, channels, etc. And a lot of them are obviously pro-BJP, pro-RSS, pro-Modi. However, you've got those few that also are very vocal and very critical as well. And you have a lot of fake news outlets. But, ones to follow are, there's one called Caravan Daily. If you Google Caravan Daily News India, that's one to follow. There's another one called the Cognate, C-O-G-N-A-T-E. There's news18.com in India. There's the wire.in. There's, actually from the newspapers, you'll find good coverage in the newspaper called the Hindu. Like you've got Hindustan Times, you've got India Today, you've got so many others, you'll find good coverage in the Hindu newspaper. So these are the various media outlets to know, to understand what's happening in Kashmir. What's been very sad is that Saudi Arabia and the UAE, as expected, threw Kashmir under the bus, so to say, whereby the lockdown happened on Monday, the 5th of August. On the 12th of August, a week later, which was Bakrid Day, Reliance Industries Limited, which is India's largest company, headed by India's richest man, Mukesh Ambani, had its 42nd AGM. And at this AGM, it was announced that they have big development plans for Kashmir. And look at the timing of this, because Modi, after the lockdown had said, and the revocation of the articles had said that, you know, has using this, you know, tactic and narrative to say that we are doing it for the betterment of, so-called betterment of the Kashmiri people, and that the only way is through the revocation of these articles so that we can develop the state. So Reliance is actually, you know, is now at the forefront of this initiative, at the behest of Modi, because they are responding to his appeal, so they claim. And, you know, and you will look at now, who is Modi's biggest financier and supporter is Mukesh Ambani. So, obviously, Reliance is going to be benefiting from this. It's going to be an economic benefit. And with people, you know, under siege and will be now desperate, they'll be forced to sell the land and leave the state. And obviously the land is going to be bought up by, you know, outside Kashmir. So you're going to have, you know, this pretext here, and it's going to be so-called development. But the development is not there to benefit the Kashmiri people. It's there to benefit, you know, Modi and his cronies. And and of course, you know, there's talk of plans of Hindu, exclusive Hindu settlements, etc., like what you've seen in the West Bank at the moment, right? So Kashmir is going to be headed to be another West Bank very soon. And this is the reality. And what's sad is that the very next day, on the 13th of August, Saudi Arabia announced, and the infamous Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, so he's known, has said that they are going to do $100 billion, in excess of $100 billion worth of its investments with India, of which Saudi Aramco Oil has purchased a 20% stake in Reliance for $75 billion. Right? Now, so Reliance comes on board so that they can take care of the oil operations of Reliance Industries. Okay? Now, you know, trade between India and the Gulf states, and actually the Arabian Peninsula, if you include Saudi Arabia as well, exceeds $100 billion a year, right? Of which half is with the UAE alone. So the UAE's portion is in excess of $50 billion a year with India, making India the UAE's second largest trading partner. Now, coupled to that, India investments in the UAE have exceeded $55 billion. Right, and given that out of every for every three Indians that are expats in the UAE, you have one UAE, one Emirati. So you can see that the involvement of India in the UAE, together with the UAE, and the UAE has been promised, together with Saudi Arabia, to be involved in the so-called development of Kashmir and the upliftment of Kashmir. But remember something: it's not for the benefit of the Kashmiri people, right? So DP World, which is known as Dubai Ports World, which manages ports globally as well, have been given the go-ahead to set up and develop a major logistics hub in Kashmir. Right, that's just one of the deals. Plus, you have this Aramco deal. So Modi, what he's trying to do is he's trying to, you know, fool the world with this narrative that I'm there to develop Kashmir for the benefit of the Kashmiri people, and I have got Muslim partners of Saudi Arabia and UAE to work with me. So, you know, all your criticisms that, you know, we want to, you know, change the demographics from Muslim majority to Hindu majority is all nonsense. But I've got, you know, your two Muslim leading countries in the world, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, to back me on this. But Modi refuses to acknowledge the fact that, you know, Saudi Arabia and UAE, unfortunately, have earned a rotten reputation, right, in the Muslim world, especially in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, and they are no longer to be trusted. Right? So you're not going to get, you know, yes, there is going to be development projects, there is going to be a so-called boom, but the people who are being marginalized will not benefit and will not see this. Like you see what's happening in the West Bank, where all the developments are there, or whether it's EU countries, whether it's the Americans that are in partnership with the Israelis to develop and set up, put up all those settlements and developments. Has it benefited the Palestinian people? No, not at all. So at the end of the day, this is, you know, it's money and greed that is causing this problem, and all to disguise the real agenda, which is to obviously upset the demographic change in the region. Now, somebody asked me about Israel's involvement in this whole thing. And, you know, they've seen a very similar tactic that what the Israelis have done with the Palestinians to what the BJP government is doing here with the Kashmiris. Yes, Israel has been very active. In fact, when the when the first lockdown on Kashmir happened between the mid-80s to, say, about over 10, 12 years ago, you must know that Kashmir was actually isolated for 20, 25 years. And then only at the time of Manmohan Singh's government did, you know, did they, you know, ease restrictions on Kashmir, that tourism again opened up, and, you know, that tourism again opened up, and, you know, you found that, because if you can recall, when people went to India in the late, from the mid to late 80s to, say, 10, 12 years ago, you could not visit Kashmir. And then suddenly people were allowed to visit Kashmir. So you had that, and then, of course, now again people are stopped from visiting Kashmir. So you have in this sort of situation. So if you look at it, during that lockdown, it has been known that Israeli agents have been operating hand in hand with the Indian intelligence, RAW, and with the military. Yes, Israel is an advisor to can be a guide to India on how to handle the situation. And if you look at the tells of both scenarios, currently the way Modi and his government is behaving with this matter on Kashmir is identical to how Israel behaves with the Palestinians. For example, can a peaceful settlement be attained? Yes, in any conflict, a peaceful solution is always attainable. But you have to have, both sides have to show genuine commitment to reaching a peaceful solution. All cards must be put down on the table. You have to be transparent. You have to allow outside mediators. And the most important thing is you have to stop the trading of the rhetoric and the insults and the blame game. Now, what's been happening here is that, like how you see in Israel-Palestine, the Israelis keep on saying the Palestinians are bad, they are terrorists, you know, they are the ones that are, you know, putting our people under fear, so if they throw stones and rockets at us, we respond with our F-16 and our tanks, right? The same thing is happening in Kashmir. When there's civil disobedience, when people are rising up, the Indian government responds harshly, right? Now, you take the Pulwama attacks, which took place on the 14th of February this year, right, which now, as you've seen what has unfolded in the past few months, especially with this, and now what's been happening currently, it was, you know, mooted at the time that this could have been a false flag operation. And now, looking at the reality of the situation, it is in all likelihood a false flag operation. Not that it is, but in all likelihood. And who benefits from such a false flag operation is the aggressor. Right? The aggressor in this case is the BJP government, and you must know that their popularity prior to Pulwama was at an all-time low. In fact, you know, from, you know, media reports, even people like Arundhati Roy, etc., were confident that the BJP was going to lose this last election. Right? But they did not factor in that Pulwama served as a catalyst, right, to the BJP's victory, or guaranteed the BJP's victory in this last election by a landslide. Right. When the BJP announced its election manifesto on the 8th of April this year, amongst its manifesto, it said that we will abrogate and revoke Article 370 and Article 35A from the Indian Constitution, and Kashmir will be part of India. Now, elections took place, the results were announced towards the end of May, and the government went into top gear immediately and worked and got this, because they have now delivered to their constituents, to their voters. And who are their voters? It's the RSS type mentality, people who are their voters and their supporters. So they said, look, we promised you we're getting Kashmir, and this is it, we've delivered. So you see that the similarities and the telltales between the two situations are very alike. Then, when in the aftermath of Pulwama, immediately, as expected, Pakistan was blamed, right? Although Pakistan did not carry out the attacks, but it was carried out by a terrorist outfit. Who is a terrorist outfit? It can be branded Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish, Muhammad, whoever it is, right? It could be the RSS as well. But the fact remains is that the narrative is there. Pakistan is responsible for this. If Pakistan did not hold the terrorists back and stop terrorism, we wouldn't have had this. Imran Khan immediately took center stage and said, listen, I condemn the Pulwama attacks, right? I am so sorry for the loss of life. Do not blame us. We are not to blame. But what we can do is let's work together to find who are the perpetrators of this. Let's work together to have a joint investigation, a transparent joint investigation with international involvement, so we can catch these suspects and bring them to book and stop this madness. And what happened? The Modi government rejected it. Right? Then they had these incursions in the Indian Air Force into Pakistani airspace, of which one of their jets was shot down, and an Indian pilot was captured. And what Imran Khan did, I mean, they could have thrown him into prison and, you know, could use him as a bargaining chip. But what he did, he showed genuine goodwill to the Indian side and gesture to say that, listen, we will release this man unconditionally as a goodwill gesture, right? Hoping that, you know, to show good faith, hoping that the Indian government will wake up and listen, okay, let's sit down and talk peace over this matter. What happened? The man was released, and basically the attitude from the Indian government is get lost, right? So you have that sort of thing. And if you look at how Israel behaves with the Palestinians, it's the same way. So Israel says, we're going to the negotiating table with the Palestinians, but remember, we are the victims here. But they are the aggressors. They're the ones that hold the largest military in the world. They are the ones that bomb with F-16 and tanks, while Palestinians only use rockets and stones. Right? So the thing here in Kashmir, how are you able to achieve a peaceful solution if the aggressor being here, the BJP government of India, is going to behave like a bully and claim to be the victim when they are the aggressor? It is not possible. So all we can say is that the only way to highlight the Kashmir cause is through civil society action, through social media action, and to be, you know, to make it known, on to bring it onto the world stage, and inshallah, through, you know, through, and keep the people of Kashmir in your duas. Not only the people of Kashmir, the people, the Rohingya, the Uyghur Muslims, the Muslims of Central Africa, Central African Republic, who are going through hell at the moment, right? Those that are in Somalia, Muslims of Yemen, of Syria, the Palestinians, and those who are facing Islamophobia around the world. Keep them all in their duas. And not just only Muslims, also those who are not Muslim, who are suffering oppression and torture and genocide, etc., and injustice. You must remember, think of them all in your duas. That's it for today on The Big Picture. Jazakallah for having me on, and look forward to speaking to you on another day, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.